For the purpose of this celebration is the 4th of July. It is the birthday of your national independence and of your political freedom. This, to you, is what the Passover was to the emancipated people of God. It carries your minds back to the day and to the act of your great deliverance, and to the signs and to the wonders associated with that act and that day. The papers and placards say that I am to deliver a 4th of July oration. This certainly sounds large and out of the common way for me. The fact is, ladies and gentlemen, the distance between this platform and the slave plantation from which I escaped is considerable. And the difficulties to be overcome in getting from the latter to the former, are by no means slight.
188 years ago this week, a small band of valiant men began a long struggle for freedom. They pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor, not only to found a nation, but to forge an ideal of freedom.
Our eyes are met with demonstrations of joyous enthusiasm. Banners and pennants wave exultingly on the breeze. The din of business, too, is hushed. Even Mammon, Sing Mammon, seems to have quitted his grasp on this day. The ear-piercing fife and the stirring drum unite their accents with the ascending peal of a thousand church bells. Prayers are made, hymns are sung, and sermons are preached in honor of this day. While the quick martial tramp of a great and multitudinous nation, echoed back by all the hills, valleys, and mountains of a vast continent, bespeak the occasion one of thrilling and universal interest, a nation's jubilee.
Back in those days, a Negro didn't mean no more to a white man than a meme.
Didn't mean as much.
You agree to that?
No, I agree to that, yeah.
Well, that's the point. That's the point we're getting to now.
We believe that all men are created equal, yet many are denied equal treatment.
Well, we had a few Negroes down there that wasn't afraid of white people and talk back to them. They call those people crazy.
Crazy people.
Yeah.
Well, I wonder why they call them crazy, because they speak up for his rights.
Yeah, they call them crazy.
Well, they do that, you know.
Yeah.
I had an uncle like that, and they hung him. They hung him down there because they say he was crazy and he might ruin the other Negro.
That's right.
Fellow citizens, pardon me. Allow me to ask, why am I called upon to speak here today? What have I, or those I represent, to do with your national independence? Are the great principles of political freedom and of national justice embodied in that Declaration of Independence extended to us? And am I therefore called upon to bring our humble offering to the national altar and to confess the benefits and express devout gratitude for the blessings resulting from your independence to us?
We believe that all men have certain unalienable rights. Yet many Americans do not enjoy those rights. We believe that all men are entitled to the blessings of liberty. Yet millions are being deprived of those blessings. Not because of their own failures, but because of the color of their skin.
All and silent, bound in jail, had no one to go their bail. Keep your hands on the plow, hold on.
In 1957, the Sovereignty Commission was founded by the Mississippi State Legislature with the stated purpose of performing acts necessary to protect the sovereignty of the state of Mississippi from encroachment by the federal government.
After a 21-year court fight, Mississippi unsealed over 124,000 pages of secret files from the Sovereignty Commission. files that revealed the use of spy tactics, intimidation, false imprisonment, jury tampering, and other illegal methods to thwart the activities of civil rights workers during the 1950s, 60s, and early 70s.
Silhouetted against the hundreds of thousands of pages of Sovereignty Commission documents facing the light of day after decades is the sinister profile of Samuel H. Bowers.
Samuel H. Bowers, a former Laurel, Mississippi businessman and the Imperial Wizard of the Mississippi White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, has been tried 5 times for ordering the murder of Vernon Dama, a Black Rosa and NAACP leader helping people to register to vote when he was killed due to the firebombing of his home on January 10, 1966.
Our program now examines the Sovereignty Commission, highlighted by the death of Vernon Dama and the latest trial of Samuel H. Bowers for arson and murder.
David Ingrid Bretson, the executive director of the Mississippi branch of the American Civil Liberties Union, discusses the Sovereignty Commission.
In 1957, the Mississippi legislature established the State Sovereignty Commission, which was to promote and protect the Southern way of life, which in reality meant to preserve segregation of the races. It quickly evolved from a public relations organization into a third-rate counterintelligence organization. It was called the KGB of the Cotton Patch at one time. It not only did public relations, but it spied on people. It surveilled people. It spread dirty rumors about people. You may have heard about some of the big names they were involved in. They coordinated surveillance on Goodman, Cheney, and Swerner, gave that information to local law enforcement officials about what station wagon Swerner was driving. And as we all know, that those 3 men were later found buried in the bank of a pond, and local law enforcement officials were charged with that murder. We know that they surveilled Medgar Evers. These are letters in the Sovereignty Commission files about trying to find something that Medgar Evers did that was illegal so that they could discredit him. They were never able to do that. They were obsessed with Martin Luther King. They tried to tar him as a communist and develop as much information as they could about him, all to no avail. But I think the real story about the Sovereignty Commission is that it spied on ordinary people. There are 85,000 names in the files of the Sovereignty Commission. 5,000 of those people were informers. And so that means that they spied on over 80,000 people. They gathered information on 80,000 people. And there are many stories that you can find in there. Since these files were opened, I have done a lot of research, spent a lot of time looking at these files, and found interesting stories. And I think, while they personally may not be appalling, in the context of the mass of work they did, it is appalling and it's chilling. There's story after story there of people who lost their jobs because the Sovereignty Commission wrote letters to the employer saying so-and-so was involved in a civil rights demonstration. We can't tell you what to do, but we know you will take appropriate action. There's a story there of a white preacher who was run out of town because he advocated integration. What is fascinating about the Sovereignty Commission is that they were obsessed with interracial dating or any type of mixed race relationship, and they investigated these exhaustively. I found a letter from the head of the Sovereignty Commission to a University of Mississippi Medical Center professor inquiring about the effects of sickle cell anemia on mixed race couples. And they thought that if there was adequate research, that would be a reason to prevent interracial marriages. But that gives you an idea of the extremes that they went to preserve segregation and to thwart the civil rights movement. One of the more interesting stories for me personally was my local neighbor, and I lived in an all-white neighborhood, was a minister who brought white college students down each summer to teach vacation Bible school in the black churches. We thought that he was a target of the Sovereignty Commission. And he left very abruptly 1 year after many years of doing this. I didn't know until looking at the files that he was a target of their investigation. And he assured them that he was for segregation, but that he thought this was an effective way to do the ministry. But even though he didn't have the courage to stand up for integration. They thought that he was a threat to the society, and he was eventually run out. What this does is create a climate of fear. And you have to realize back then there was an almost palpable climate of fear. People were afraid to speak out. They were afraid to do what's right. And so when you read the story of these people who are named in these files, who had the courage to stand up and do what was right, and many of them knew that they would be beaten, that they would be jailed, yet they did it anyway. It's a tremendous story. On the other side, you have the story of the Sovereignty Commission, which didn't operate alone. As I said earlier, there are 5,000 named informers there. Virtually the whole apparatus of state and local government was arrayed against the civil rights movement. But in terms of what the Sovereignty Commission's action did and what the civil rights movement meant for Mississippi today, there are still some effects left over from that. The truth is that we are a racially polarized state and a racially polarized city. So we have a lot of problems to solve and a lot of work left to be done. What I think is interesting in thinking about the Sovereignty Commission files and what they meant in terms of what the state did to thwart the movement and what the people did to succeed is that the legacy of the civil rights movement is very important. You have to realize that when we had so many people murdered during the civil rights movement and virtually no one convicted of those murders, one of the reasons was that black people could not vote. And because they couldn't vote, they couldn't serve on juries. And so you had virtually all white, mostly all male juries, sitting in judgment on these men, sometimes sheriffs, sometimes community leaders, sometimes Klan leaders, and acquitting them or ending up in hung juries. The reason that you saw Byron DeLay Beckwith convicted a few years ago was because of the civil rights movement, because the right of African Americans to vote was won. They vote in strength. Their votes mean something to politicians and prosecutors. And also they could sit on that jury. And that's why Byron DeLay Beckwith was convicted, because, you know, in a sense, the civil rights movement won. The flip side and the bad side of that is what the legacy of the Sovereignty Commission is. And I often say to people, my biggest problem in Mississippi is not our conservative governor. It's not our legislature. It's not some of the prosecutors, but it's silence. And it's the silence of political leaders who know the right thing to do and won't do it. It's the silence of the local bar. In Mississippi, there's not a single major law firm that will ever take an ACLU case or a civil rights case because they don't want to offend their other clients. So we have very few lawyers who are willing to continue in the work that started in the civil rights movement. And it's also the silence of the people. People are afraid to stand up and speak out for their rights. And I think that's one of the hangovers, the legacy of the Sovereignty Commission, is that people don't realize what their rights are in Mississippi yet, and that we still have to fight for them and educate them and find people courageous enough to stand up for them.
So in the early 60s, when President Johnson came in and various civil rights bills were signed, and particularly the Voting Rights Act picked up, things were moving along quite well. Looked like the civil rights situation and the racial situation in Mississippi was about to change. My father had been talking with the officials downtown about bringing the poll tax books out to his grocery store. so the local citizens in the area could come to his grocery store and pay their poll tax.
The night of June 10th, when we told the people to go down and to demonstrate, to go down to the jail and to pray for those that were in prison. Even there that night when Chief McCain said, I'm tired of you niggers eating off of me like leeches, eating off this community like leeches. They put the hoses on them and hosed them down with high-pressure hoses. The water was so forceful until it washed human bodies down the street like trash. The water was so powerful until it knocked bark off trees. Amen. And it was so powerful until people were screaming in the midst of the water as though they were caught in a fire without any escape. But God worked a wonder there. Yeah, we might think that all hope was gone, but one thing God didn't do. God didn't let nobody become blind. God did not let nobody die. God didn't let nobody get discouraged. But God took those little people and raised them up until the next day they walked down the streets again.
We declare our right on this earth to be a man, to be a human being, to be respected as a human being, to be given the rights of a human being in this society, on this earth, in this day, which we intend to bring into existence by any means necessary.
I woke up this morning when the man
said, I'm freedom. Oh, and I woke up this morning when the man said, I'm freedom. Oh, and I woke up this morning when the man
custard pie of a town. Dream within a dream. Our dream deferred.
You know, they passed a law in Arkansas, no hitchhiking.
Yeah.
And one afternoon, I was hitchhiking, trying to get around to Little Rock, and so a fellow by the name of Mr. Cuff, he was the baddest in the latter part of Arkansas. So he said, "Well, you doing hitchhiking here, fella, a boy?" I said, "Well, say, I'm trying to get home to work." He said, "Why you working? Who you work for?" I said, "I work in Hughes for Mr. Charlie Hughes." So he said, "Come on, I'll take you there." You know what I mean? In other times,
you'd have whipped the other man.
Yeah, don't be working. You'd have got a whipping.
That's right, yeah.
And went to jail and went to the levee and went to the farm.
Went out on the farm and worked for no pay.
But one day, a lady by the name of Rosa Parks decided that she wasn't going to take it any longer. She stayed on a bus seat. You may not remember it because it's way back now, several years, but it was the beginning of a movement where 50,000 black men and women refused absolutely to ride the city buses, and we walked together for 381 days.
Yes, sir.
A Monday morning early at approximately 2 o'clock a.m., two carloads of Klansmen from the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan arrived at my father's place. The Klansmen dismounted the vehicles and started firing their weapons into the picture window of the house and into the plate glass display window of the store. After breaking the windows, they proceeded to fill the house with gasoline by tossing in Molotov cocktails. My father jumped from his bed and called out for the family. He says, "We've been hit. Get up and get out of the house." And at that time, he started firing back at the Klansmen who were firing into the house, hoping with their weapons, hoping to keep the family in the house and burn the entire family. So while he was firing back to keep them warded off, the other members of the family in the residence were getting out of the house through a back window.
Samuel H. Bowers, who served 6 years in connection with one of the killings of the three civil rights workers, James Cheney, Andrew Goodman, and Michael Schwerner, in 1964, slithers past us on our eerie journey into a shadowy past where the files of the Mississippi State Sovereignty Commission provide a profoundly unsettling reminder of the state's determination to maintain a segregated society.
Rita Schwerner Bender, attorney, activist, and the widow of Michael Schwerner.
I think it is very hard for most of us to comprehend the notion of a government as out of control and run amok in the way in which the Sovereignty Commission records document that the government of the state of Mississippi was for many years. And I think there's a tendency not to want to believe it. I don't want to believe it. I think it is a part of history that we have to understand because it is part of United States history. And it's a chilling lesson in what happens if there are not proper safeguards upon governmental power. On the one hand, the significance of their release at this point is that they were not released many years ago, and that it took 21 years of a lawsuit brought by the ACLU of Mississippi to accomplish the release of the files. The fact that they are now open means that a lot of this history can be examined and perhaps some more understanding of what went on and what the state's involvement was may come to light. I should say that there's a good many of the documents that were in the files originally we know were destroyed because one of the memos that is in the file is a memorandum, I believe, from the director of the Sovereignty Commission to the governor's assistant in about 1965, indicating that the files were undergoing a purge. This was a legislatively created arm of the government. It was created in, I believe, 1956, and it existed until 1977. So it was an arm of the government, and it employed investigators who spied upon people living in the state of Mississippi, wrote reports upon people's lawful activities, and then the Sovereignty Commission engaged in a variety of illegal activities in order to prevent any breakdown of the segregated state. I've seen my file. I have not yet seen all of Mickey's file. The investigator for the Sovereignty Commission reports on both Mickey and myself and includes such things as the car we drive and its license number and description of each of us and where we live and the address of where we live and who is the owner of the building in which we live and an indication that I purchased a sewing machine. I think that the significance of the purchase of the sewing machine is not, I mean, when I first read it, I have to say I laughed, and then I thought about it, and I was quite chilled by it, because the fact that we were being surveilled to such an extent that somebody knew of a matter as trivial as the purchase of a sewing machine is quite astounding. As of March 17th, the files were opened, and my understanding is that the documents were computerized, and there are two computers available for public use and one for the press, and I was in fact informed by a reporter in Jackson that they were giving out lottery numbers for reporters to use the one computer that was available. I have not gotten to see Mickey's file because I requested that it be sent to me, and no one has responded from the state to my request. So I don't know whether they will send it to me or whether I am actually going to have to get somebody to go in and get it for me or go to Mississippi myself to get it. I think the fact that a government can institutionalize its response to people's lawful activities to the point that there's violence committed. I mean, these folks, the Sovereignty Commission, they were doing such things as trying to pull a trucker's long-distance hauling license because he owned a part interest in a black motel which he was making available for civil rights meetings. There is a document in the files which indicates that a white woman called the Sovereignty Commission complaining that her daughter was dating a black man, and the response to that was, we'll contact the draft board about this. We'll take care of that. This is governmental interference in people's lives in a very frightening way. And I think recognizing that a government which on the surface is lawfully created and is performing lawful functions is in fact engaged in such clandestine activities indicates that if we allow ourselves to slip back into a notion that we no longer have to be addressing and correcting the legacy of slavery and the legacy of racial injustice in this country, then I worry that the next step is a more proactive, what do we do to keep people in their place? Certainly the segregated South fell and probably will never be the same. Certainly the opening up of the election process occurred. There are all kinds of issues about who votes and who doesn't and why, but certainly that changed. And I think that in many ways, this country was moving towards a more inclusive society. I think the last few years there has been some frightening backsliding. Certainly the attack on affirmative action is an effort to pretend that hundreds of years of history are cured in 30 years and we can go on business as usual now. So that effort at eliminating affirmative action is very frightening because the economic distinctions between whites and people of color in this country are still quite dramatic. I think that there may be situations in which criminal indictments are appropriate. You know, there never was a murder trial in the case of Mickey Schwerner, James Chaney, and Andrew Goodman. So there may be further materials here that are relevant to criminal prosecutions, to civil claims. I would think that there are probably lots and lots of people who have civil claims against the state of Mississippi.
He sent out the call. No Negro rode the buses. It was one of the most amazing things I've ever seen in my life. The people of Montgomery asked me to serve as a spokesman. And as the president of the new organization, the Montgomery Improvement Association, that came into being to lead the boycott, I couldn't say no. And then we started our struggle together. Things were going well for the first few days, but then, about 10 or 15 days later, after the white people in Montgomery knew that we meant business, they started doing some nasty things. They started making nasty telephone calls and came to the point that some days more than 40 telephone calls have come in threatening my life, the life of my family, the life of my children. I took it for a while in a strong manner. I never will forget one night very late. It was around midnight. And you can have some strange experiences at midnight. I had been out meeting with the steering committee all that night. I came home. My wife was in the bed and I immediately crawled into bed to get some rest, to get up early the next morning to try to keep things going. And immediately, the telephone started ringing and I picked it up. On the other end was an ugly voice.
We believe that all men are created equal.
Your high independence only reveals the immeasurable distance between us. The blessings in which you this day rejoice are not enjoyed in common. The rich inheritance of justice, liberty, prosperity, and independence bequeathed by your fathers is shared by you, not by me. The sunlight that brought light and healing to you has brought stripes and death to me. This 4th of July is yours, not mine. You may rejoice. I must mourn.